Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Nice to see you all here. Nice to see everyone here at the Shia. I've been asked to say that today's Shia has been sponsored by Ilu Neshama, Miriam Bas Avraham, Shem Tov Ben Shlema. Thank you for your sponsorship. I'd like today to look at, if you have a look at your sheet in front of you, it looks like something of a battle. If you look at the sheet, the great rabbinic debate of the 19th century. And I've got here six names. Between them, these six names really were the orthodox rabbinic leaders of hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of Jews in Central Eastern Europe in the 19th century. And their writings are still with us and very influential. And I'd like to talk about a debate that they had 150 years ago or so regarding Pesach. I dealt with this issue a year ago in the connection of, we were discussing Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch. We were looking through the life and times of Samson Raphael Hirsch and the challenges that he had and the way he dealt with them. And in that context, I looked at it then, but I'm going to revisit it. This is part two of a talk that I gave then about a year ago. But even if you weren't there, or you were there but you don't remember it verbatim, we're going to be looking at this again. Let me give you a little bit of an introduction to the topic. And the topic, of course, this time of year, what are we all doing? We're buying matzahs, right? Who here is not buying matzahs? Everybody is getting stocked up with matzahs. You go to the shop, and what do you find? You find square matzahs and round matzahs. And you got to choose square matzahs or round matzahs. And most people choose on the basis of a tradition in the family, or whether they can pay the price for the round matzahs, right? Or aesthetic reasons, one thing and another. What do you use? What is the difference between machine matzahs and round matzahs? We all know. The answer is that the square matzahs are made by a machine. That's why they come out square. The round matzahs are made by hand. They are hand matzahs, hand kneaded, hand rolled, hand chopped up, hand put into the oven. Everything is done by hand by workers who've been trained to do so. Machine matzahs are made by machine. You pour the flour and the water into two different containers, a bit like your washing machine. You know, you put in the water and the soap, press the button, and everything happens. The machine kneads it, the machine pounds it, the machine flattens it, the machine puts it on a conveyor belt, it goes straight into the oven, goes through the oven on a conveyor belt, comes out the other side, goes straight into a box, nobody touches it, right? This is the machine matzah is available, and I think I seem to remember last year reading that Manischewitz made 100 million machine matzahs. So we're talking about a pretty big business, right? The matzahs business in general. Hand matzahs business is also a massive, massive business. Okay, what is the issue between hand matzahs? Why do we have two different types of matzahs? And what is the issue? And why is that interesting? So let's first go back a little bit and learn a little bit of something about the halachas of what is a kosher matzah to use on Pesach. Right? And what's very important to realize is that on Pesach, there are two different halachic requirements for eating matzah. One of them is on Seder night, right? The first bit of matzah you eat at the beginning of the meal and the last bit of matzah you eat at the end of the meal that we usually call afikomen, that isn't just eating because you're hungry, that isn't just eating matzah because bread is forbidden, that is eating matzah because there's a mitzvah ba'erev tochlu matzot. That's what the pasuk says. There's a mitzvat asay, one of the 613 mitzvahs, to eat matzah on Seder night. This is an active mitzvah to eat it, and therefore when we're eating the matzah, we're fulfilling that mitzvah. When you eat matzahs during Chol HaMoed, or you eat matzahs even during the meal on Seder night or the next day, that is a nice thing to do. If you're hungry, you can eat matzahs, but that's not a fulfillment of a mitzvah. That's just, that is not chometz. It's kosher Pesach food, which is satisfying and nice to eat, but that's not a mitzvah to do. What is the difference between these two things? You're eating matzah here, you're eating matzah there. What's the difference between eating matzah at the as the first and last part of Seder night? Incidentally, people sometimes make a mistake about the afikoma. I think it's worth mentioning here as a footnote. People tend to think that afikomen, eating the matzah at the end of the meal, is something which happens sort of by the way, a little bit of a nibble at the end of the meal. This is not the case. The last kazayit of matzah that you eat at the end of the meal is as important, halachically, as the first bit of matzah you eat at the beginning of the meal, right? And therefore it's important when you're eating the meal and serving the meal to leave a bit of room, right, for eating properly, not just a bit of a nibble, but a significant amount of matzah for the afikomen at the end. The Rambam, incidentally, writes in Hilchot Chametz Matzah, chapter 8, he writes that in the today we have an abundance of everything in terms of food and also in terms of shmura matzahs. But if somebody has only one kazayit of shmura matzah, he should eat it at the end of the meal rather than the beginning of the meal, because the end of the meal, says the Rambam, is the main mitzvah. So, but the mitzvah itself of achilat matzah is both at the beginning and at the end. Why is that important in terms of your shopping? And the answer is because when you go to the store, you will find on the shelf there are matzot regilot, ordinary matzahs, and then there are shmura matzahs. What is the difference between a matzah regila and a shmura matzah? Does anybody know what the difference is between an ordinary matzah and a shmura matzah? I guarantee you in the ingredients, there's no difference at all. The ingredients is water and flour, right? Some people tend to think that regular matzahs are kosher Pesach, but shmura matzahs are super kosher Pesach. They're sort of mahadrin kosher Pesach. That's also not true, right? Hopefully, your regular matzahs are also mahadrin kosher Pesach, right? All the matzahs that you eat have to be super kosher Pesach. So what is it about shmura matzahs that make them more important, different, and indeed more expensive, right? What is it about them? And the answer is, there's a pasuk in the Torah, in addition to saying, Ba'erev tochlu matzot, there's a mitzvah to eat the matzahs, there's a pasuk which says, Ushmartem es ha-matzot. The matzahs need a shemira. What is this shemira? The shemira is, here comes an interesting concept, that the matzah, which you're going to eat for the mitzvah, has to be made lishmo. What does that mean to make it lishma? It means that in the manufacture of the matzah, the person making the matzah has to have in mind that this is being made l'shem mitzvat matzah. And if you visit a hand-baking matzah factory, I'm sure some of you have. If you haven't, it's worth doing, right? Just to visit, you will see lots of people rolling and kneading, and all the time they're mumbling. What are they mumbling? They're mumbling. What are they mumbling? L'shem mitzvahs matzah. L'shem mitzvahs matzah. L'shem. We're doing this for the purpose of mitzvat matzah. We're doing this for the purpose not simply to produce matzah, which isn't chametz. We're producing matzah for Leil Seder, for the mitzvah of al achilah shekidishonu, b'mitzosah v'tzivonu al achilas matzah. That is shmura matzahs. Okay. So here we're getting into a very, very interesting historical debate, which started off as a halachic debate. And as you know, there are halachic debates about different kashrut and different shemitah and different things, all sorts of different halachic debates, which are fine. This debate went nuclear. Sometimes debates don't remain within the Beis HaMedrash. This debate became probably the most emotional. The Jewish people from Moshe Rabbeinu until 1850 all ate hand matzahs because there were no machine matzahs, there were no machines. Okay, that's my hakdama, that's the first introductory obvious point, right? Everybody for 3,500 years was eating hand matzahs. Came along some bright lad in the mid-19th century as part of the Industrial Revolution. They were making machines to do everything. Machines were doing the weaving, machines were doing the printing, machines were doing the cutting, machines were doing, right? People weren't on horse and wagon anymore, they were going by trains. These were massive innovations in European culture in the 19th century, right? So somebody invented a machine to make matzahs. Don't forget, this is before electricity. So in actual, the machine doesn't work on the basis of electricity. There's a guy turning handles, and there are gears, and that makes the thing work. But I'll call upon him, it's a machine. and you put in the ingredients, and at the other end comes out a baked matzah. That's the machine. This is the debate. The debate is, are we going to use on Pesach matzahs made by machine? Our fathers and grandfathers and great-grandfathers all made, all ate for Seder night round-hand matzahs, and now we are going to eat square machine-made matzahs. Is that right? Is that a good thing to do? Hayitachen? Is that possible? Okay. So what happened was, the machine was introduced into a few communities, and some people used it, some people didn't. At a certain point, have a look at your sheet in front of you just for a minute. I'd like to use today's shiur to introduce you to six very influential and important rabbonim in the 19th century. We'll be learning more about them as we go along, but here, they were the stars of this engagement, right? So the first one is Reb Shlomo Kluger, who was the rabbi of Brody. Brody was one of the big Jewish centers in what used to be called Galicia and is now called the Ukraine. Okay, Galicia was a major center of Judaism, and particularly of Hasidic Judaism. And Reb Shlomo Kluger was recognized throughout the Jewish world and to this day as a major halachic authority. You can see I've written down here, in addition to being the rabbi of Brody, he was also the responsor. He wrote Sha'alot Tshuvot called Ha'elef L'Chol Shlomo, and he also wrote a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, which is printed in your standard Shulchan Aruch, Chochmat Shlomo, and he was considered to be, and still is today, considered to be one of the most significant halachic authorities of the 19th century. Reb Shlomo Kluger, widely respected across the Orthodox Jewish world, unquestionably. What happened is, it is interesting that this drama that we're learning about this morning takes place, sadly, in exactly the same cities where now there is, sadly, a lot of fighting going on. Hashem HaKadosh Baruch Hu should look after them. I call upon him, Reb Shlomo Kluger is the first main player in this controversy, and he publishes a pamphlet called Moda'a LeYisrael. Moda'a means I'm giving a... notification. I'm giving a notification to the Jews of Europe that what? That machine matzahs are no good. Don't use machine matzahs. And he gives a whole list of reasons why machine matzahs are no good, right? The machine is difficult to clean, there'll be bits of dough stuck on it, and it'll come chometz, it'll go into the next thing, and he brings all sorts of other considerations. Of all his considerations, the central, if you like, halachic issue that he brings, right, is something which is actually worthy of consideration. And that is, can the machine make matzot lishma? Think about it for a second. What's happening at the machine-making factory? What's happening is that the mashgiach, the rabbi in charge of the plant of the machine, what's going to happen is he's going to say out loud l'shem mitzvat matzah. He's going to push a button and that's it. He can go home for the day, right? That's it. Nothing else is done l'shem mitzvat matzah. The machine does everything. It kneads, it mixes, it pounds, it flattens, it cuts it, it bakes it. It's everything, and it's all. Is that sufficient? Is the l'shem mitzvah of the machine? Now everybody agrees that the machine matzahs are really. Well, not like everybody agrees. Let's agree for the moment that machine matzahs are kosher l'Pesach, as matzot regilot, as ordinary matzahs. But can they be used as shemura matzahs or not? That was the main question halachically that Reb Shlomo Kluger was dealing with. And he came down resoundingly as no. There's no way you can use machine matzahs. And what happened was that he was gathering, once he published his pamphlet, the pamphlet snowballed and gathered some speed and support. And have a look at the next two names on your sheet. Underneath Reb Shlomo Kluger, you have Reb Yitzchok Meir Alter, Itchamaya is a famous of the Gerach Hasidim. He was the Rebbe of the Gerach Hasidim. He was known as you can see, I've written down under his name, the Chidushei Horim. The Chidushei Horim wrote commentaries on the Gemara, wrote commentaries on the Chumash, and was considered one of the most prominent Hasidic rebbes of the 19th century, and the leader of the Gera Hasidim dynasty, which was in Poland one of the biggest. I don't know if any of you come from Gera Hasidim, but Gera Hasidim was one of the biggest dynasties of Hasidus in Poland at the time. And he also looked at this machine, and he agreed with Shlomo Kluger that Chas v'Shalom, one shouldn't use machine matzahs for Seder night. And not only for Seder night, but actually he took the view that one shouldn't use them at all. They're not reliable. We're not going to use machine matzahs for anything at all. We are going to stick to hand matzahs. I want to emphasize the fact that in the Hasidic, if you like, in the Hasidic ethos, the Hasidic hashkafa, the concept of preserving the minhag avotenu, preserving things in the way that earlier generations did it, that is a value in and of itself. In other words, when we are, in a sense, also Hasidic ways of dressing. They dressed the way their fathers and grandfathers dressed, even though there were new fashions and new ways of doing it. They spoke the language of Yiddish like their grandfathers spoke. They weren't willing to learn Polish or Russian or German, because part of Hasidus was to preserve the masoires of earlier generations, said Rabbi Yitzchok Meir Alter, and the other prominent Hasidic leader of the time, the Divrei Chaim, who was Rabbi Chaim Halberstam of Tzanz, right? He also agreed that actually none of his Hasidim should eat any machine matzahs at all. So what you have here was a real block of the most prominent Orthodox Jewish leaders of the period, who were coming together and publishing their view that machine matzahs were off the menu. Right? Off the menu. Okay, so that's a good point. That's a good point. So the answer is yesh v'yesh. Some of them did it this way. They all agree that certainly not for Leil Seder. Some of them went further and said you shouldn't have it in your house at all. Because the question was, it depended what their main reason was. If they believed that the reason was that the machine was not easy to supervise, and that a machine has got lots of wheels and cogs and gears, and it's got little moving parts. And when you're dealing with dough, the dough gets sticky and it gets stuck in between. And then you'll run your machine, and then you'll clean it, and then you'll run it again, right? But there's still some dough stuck from before, and that dough has meanwhile become chametz. Let me just explain to you a little bit what goes on in a matzah machinery. I've been a couple of times in some of these, Cohen Halperin, one of the big Jerusalem machine matzah factories. I went with my Rebbe, Rabbi Shur Neuwirth, who was the Rebbe of the author of Shmir Shabbos Kilchosa, one of the poskim of the previous generation, who I was zocher to learn from for many years. So I went with him a couple of times to his annual visit to be mashkiach in the Cohen Halperin factory. And it's amazing what goes on there, right? You've got this enormous machine, bigger than this room, right? And you have lots of workers, and there's a clock. The clock is the most important item in the room, right? And there's a clock, right? And then a bell goes off. And then they put the water in and the flour in, and it starts going, da, 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 and it's pounding, and flattening, and going in the conveyor belt into the oven. And then at a certain point, 18 minutes are up. That's it. The machine is switched off. The machine is switched off. That's it. It's finished. Right? Any dough that hasn't gone into the oven by then is put in the waste. Okay, all right, yes. Okay, 17, 17 and a half. Right, there are some, actually, most of the poskim say that it's more than 18. It doesn't matter. It's known as the 18-minute rule. That's what it's known as, right? A cold body, but what happens then is, and then they start cleaning, right? So they start cleaning all the surfaces and cleaning the conveyor belt and cleaning all the machines and cleaning out the bowl of the kneading. And everything gets cleaned out. It takes longer to clean than to bake. In terms of man hours, what's going on here is that the cleaning of it is, in fact, now what we have today, so for example in Cohen Halperin, what they've got is high pressure water and high pressure air, right? So if you use high pressure, very, very high pressure, world high pressure air, you get rid of every single crumb. Every single crumb is gotten rid of, and they can clean, and all the surfaces are wiped down, and everything. It is a challenge to do it. Go back 150 years ago, they didn't have high pressure water and high pressure air, right? They didn't even have lots of these types of cloths and detergents and cleaning materials that we have today. They didn't have anything plastic or anything like that. Didn't have stainless steel. So we're dealing with surfaces that weren't so smooth, bowls that weren't so easily cleanable. And lots of these post-game took the view, look, there's no way you can clean a machine sufficiently to make sure there's no chametz in it, and therefore it's chametz. I must tell you, fast forward a little bit, to this day, there are many Hasidic communities for whom the idea of buying machine matzahs is a horrendous idea. They would never in their life have machine matzahs in the house on Pesach, right? And you should know that if you're inviting any Hasidic people to your table or you're visiting them, you should know it's only hand matzahs the whole way through. Because they have a tradition from the Gera Rebbe and from Reb Chaim Tzanz. You may be familiar with the name Tzanz from Kiryat Tzanz in Netanya, right? Kiryat Tzanz, the Laniado Hospital is built in Kiryat Tzanz because the famous Kloisenberger Rebbe, Zichron Livracha, the famous Kloisenberger Rebbe, Zichron Livracha, was a survivor of the Holocaust. He lost his whole family in the concentration camps. He came to Netanya and he built up Kiryat Tzanz in Netanya. I'm sure some of you are familiar with it. Just north of Netanya is a whole big built-up Hasidic area called Kiryat Tzanz, where they built a new hospital, that are now the hospital. Why am I mentioning all that? Because the Kloisenberger Rebbe came from Tzanz. And he had the minhagim and the rulings of the Reb Chaim Halberstam of Tzanz, the Divrei Chaim, and therefore in Tzanz there aren't any machine matzahs. There are no machine matzahs. It's considered to be chametz. Right? It's considered to be unacceptable completely. Coming back to your question, that Tzanz was very machmir on this. He didn't just say don't eat them for Seder night. He said you can't eat them at all. Right? So you had, and to this day, this machlokes is still alive and well, right, in many Hasidic communities. But at that time, this was the view that was put out very vociferously and very definitively by Reb Shlomo Kluger, the Gera Rebbe, and the Tzanzer Rebbe, and they were, if you like, a group, a voice, which was to be reckoned with. However, they were not the only voice in Europe at the time, and hence you will see in the sheet in front of you, you will see under these three names, I've written versus. It sounds like a boxing match of some sort, right? In one corner you had these, and in that corner you had those. And there was a bit of that, because some of these debates were a bit angry. If you look at what's written, some of them were like very angry about it. And we'll come to in a minute to what was there to be angry about. But there was something here to be angry about. So we have have a look at the last three names on your list. And these are also some of the most significant rabbinic authorities in Europe at the time. What is special, I just want to, as a footnote here, I want to tell you what is special about these six individuals. These six individuals were all known in Europe, not just as community rabbis or spiritual leaders, but they were all known as halachic authorities. These are all poskim. Not all spiritual leaders were known as halachic authorities. Right? Some Hasidic rabbis never ever taught halacha or wrote about halacha at all. They had in their town a couple of dayanim who dealt with halachic issues, but they themselves wasn't their department. Equally, in the Lithuanian world, there were great rosh yeshivas, right, who never got involved in halacha at all. And I remember even when I spent a few years in the Miri Yeshiva with Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, Zechar Tzadik Livracha, and he was a Gaon Olam, probably one of the biggest Gaonim in his generation in terms of Talmud and Shas and everything that went with that. But if you went to ask him a halachic shaila, he would send you to one of the local Dayanim. He would never paskin anything. He wouldn't paskin any halachas. It was not his business. He was not into psikat halacha. That wasn't his wasn't his field. So you had both in the Hasidic and in the Lithuanian world great Talmidei Chachamim who were non-halachic in that sense, in the sense that they didn't consider themselves to be in the role of giving halachic rulings. But these six individuals all wrote extensively what is called Sheilot or Tshuvot. They wrote responsa on complex halachic matters and were considered to be halachic authorities, and that was their field. So have a look at the last three names here just for a minute. These are names generally people are interested in Jewish life 150 years ago, right? Should know that these are the names of the people who were the movers and shakers in the Orthodox Jewish world. The first one was someone who was known as the Ketav Sofer. He was the Rav of Presburg. So Presburg in Hungary was a major Jewish center, but it wasn't Hasidic, right? It was a very Haredi center, but they were a different type. They were Ashkenaz, they daven Nusach Ashkenaz, and they didn't consider themselves to Hasidim. His father was called the Chatam Sofer, right? The Chasam Sofer was also arguably the greatest halachic authority in Europe in the previous generation, and his son, the Ksav Sofer, Rav Avraham Shmuel Binyamin Sofer, was also in that mold, a posek and a halachic authority, and he went to have a look at the machines, Gesundheit, he went to have a look at the matzah machines, and his conclusion was, terrific, this is a major contribution to Jewish life, major contribution. Because these machines do the work of 100 men. And I'd like to add something to this. I'd like to add something to the argument of the people who were pro the machines. And this was that there was quite a lot of... He writes about the fact that he has inspected and he has seen and he's had reports from quite a few of the hand matzah factories. So let me ask you a question. Who are the people working in the hand matzah factories? These aren't the most talented, careful, knowledgeable, mature people in the community. These are kinderlach. These are teenagers, or even less than teenagers, right? These are people who are lo yutzlach, who've got no other job, unemployed people. Yes, they were people, and often they weren't doing a great job. They were sitting there and they were getting on with it, but they weren't really interested, and they took a break, and they didn't. And some of them got very tired, and they were sweating, and maybe they were spitting and talking to each other. And some of them even they were under such a lot of pressure to produce so many matzahs per day that in one place he writes that they didn't take a lunch break, so they brought their sandwiches into the matzah baking factory, and while they're doing their thing, they're having the sandwiches. And it's difficult to monitor because it's just everything's happening fast. There are lots and lots of people. It's a big noise, right? So he says the people working in the hand matzahs. He says, if you can give me a machine that will do this work, and I can regulate this machine and monitor this machine, this is fantastic. We're going to avoid 1,000 different problems of chametz. In addition to which, he was also, because he was a bit the Ksav Sofer, the Chasam Sofer were a bit sort of what we would call today a bit yekkers. In other words, they were very, I mean it now in the sense they were very particular on hygiene issues. Forget it, pedantic in matters of hygiene. Forget about halacha. Hygiene for them was an extremely important issue. And he felt that if we could have a machine, we would raise the level of hygiene of these matzahs enormously, because hand matzahs depends on the hygiene of this teenager who's been running around. He hasn't bathed for maybe a couple of weeks, and he's rolling his pin, and he's scratching himself, and he's using a thing, and he's scratching his head. And Now the truth is, today this is monitored much more carefully. Everybody incidentally in the hand matzah factories, they all have to wear disposable plastic clothing and disposable plastic gloves, right? And they work in shifts, and they're very, very careful in the hand. So these problems don't exist anymore today in the hand, generally speaking, in the hand. The Ksav Sofer says we have both chometz problems and hygiene problems in our hand baking, but we have no alternative. That's the only way we can bake matzahs. Give me a machine, we'll monitor the machine, we'll clean the machine, and this is one of the great gifts to mankind.
I the Indian Kabbalah.
So we're going to have to deal with, and I have to deal with that still, there is still the question mark about kavana. Can a machine make it lishma? Okay. Let's put that on hold just for a couple of minutes. But he was very enthusiastic about it. And he said, look, we are using we are beneficiaries of the Industrial Revolution at so many different levels. We all go by train. We all go by train. We don't go by horse and cart anymore, right? We all have got printing presses. We don't have books written by hand scribes, right? And he gives a whole list, because he didn't have what we have today, the benefits of modernity in that sense. But he says all this, the machine for matzah is in that category. The next person here will be Saul Lifshitz, also a very, very interesting person. Maybe once I'll give a whole shiur on him. He was the rabbi of Danzig, which is today called Gdansk in Poland. It was a big commercial center with a very big Jewish community. And for those people who learn the Mishnah, you will know that in every standard publication of the Mishnah, there is a commentary called Tiferet Yisrael. The Tiferet Yisrael of the Mishnah was written by Rabbi Yisrael Lifshitz. And in addition to that, he was a halachic authority in Europe at the time. And in a sense, at the bottom of the page, you have probably the only person here who, in a sense, in terms of the perspective of Orthodox Judaism in the 19th century, was the equal, an equal to Reb Shlomo Kluger. Shlomo Kluger was a massive halachic authority. Reb Shlomo Kluger wrote over 100 books, right, and was considered to be very influential. But he was prolific. He was brilliant, and he was an extremely competent Rav of Brody. Now, in Galicia, there were two main centers of Jewish life. There was Jewish life in all the shtetlach, all around the place, but two big cities which were considered not only concentrations of Jewish community, but also of Torah and learning. One was Brody, where Rav Shlomo Kluger lived, and the other one was Lvov, sometimes called Lviv. The Germans called it Lemberg. It's difficult. These borders moved a lot. Poland, sometimes it was Poland, sometimes it was Ukraine, sometimes it was Germany. There was a lot of moving around the borders at the time. Anyhow, this town, what? And unfortunately, this is still happening. So this town, Lvov, right, was a very big center, an important center of Jewish life. And the posek in Lvov was someone called Rav Yosef Shaul Natanzon. The Yosef Shaul Natanzon wrote many volumes of halachic responsa called Responsa Shoel Umeshiv. And he was known as the Shoel Umeshiv. That's what he was known as. All these people, incidentally, many of them were known by the names of their books, right? Like we speak about the Chofetz Chaim, right? Chofetz Chaim wasn't his name, that was the name of his book, right? We often refer to Gedolei Yisrael by the names of their books. So he was known as the Shoel Umeshiv. He then, in Lemberg, now don't forget, Lemberg from Brody is only about 100 miles away from each other. They're not far away. And they often work together. Rabbi Kluger and Rabbi Natanzon were like colleagues in many ways, right? But on this issue, Rav Natanzon looked at the machine matzahs and he said, this machine is a major gift to Jewish life. We will, and one of the issues that he was concerned about, he was dealing with lots of people who were living below the poverty level. And he was impressed by the fact that we could produce matzahs at a price that everybody could afford them. Nobody could not afford machine matzahs, whereas hand matzahs were much more work intensive, were much more expensive, right? And there were monopolies of various sorts. So the machine matzahs was for him, first of all, a great economic gift to Klal Yisrael, but also, he said, it was a great gift in terms of the increases in monitoring, as I said before, issues of hygiene and also chametz. He said that he saw some hand matzah machines, hand matzah factories, where because they had a shortage of labor, they brought in non-Jews. Now, of course, if a non-Jew says l'shem mitzvah matzah, it doesn't help. If you look in the Shulchan Aruch, Aruch Chayim, Hilchos Pesach, Siman Tov Samach, in Siman Tov Samach, it speaks about it has to be a Jewish person who makes it l'shma. has to be made lishma, l'shein mitzvahs matzah. If a non-Jew does it, it's no good. So he says, because of shortage of laborers, they brought in non-Jews because they just needed people who were willing to do this this particular work. He said also, look, people say, look, the round matzah has got the roundness of it, the shape of the matzahs became an issue as well. We have a tradition of round matzahs. Who's ever heard of square matzahs? So he's got a whole paragraph in his tshuvas of the lechem haponim in the Beis HaMikdash, which were square, right? Or oblong, basically, more correctly. They were made oblong. So he says, there's nothing holy about the round matzahs. It just so happens to be that what they used to make them, they rolled the dough into a long, like, sausage, cut it into, like, pennies, and the pennies were then flattened, and then you produced. But that was just by chance. There's nothing holy about the round matzah as opposed to the square matzah. This then became a very big issue. And within a year of Rabbi Shlomo Kluger publishing his Moda'ah LeYisrael, Rav Natan Zana published another pamphlet against him called Bitul Moda'ah. Bitul Moda'ah means the annulment of the announcement. In other words, this announcement came out of Brody, and out of Lemberg came the Bitul Moda'ah. And this was the most motivated and emotional debate. And of course, you had to make a decision. Everybody had to make a decision. What are you going to buy for Pesach? Are you going to buy these matzahs or those matzahs? And whether you bought these or those matzahs depended on your allegiance. Were you a Tzanz HaKosit? Were you a Gera Chosid? Where did you live? Who was your Rebbe? What do you believe in? And then other people said, no, it doesn't matter who you believe in. What's the reality of it? Are they kosher? It became a massive, massive issue. Yes, you want to make a point?
Yeah,
at the time, let me just say one thing. In the Beis HaMikdash, all the bread was matzah. In other words, the Pasuk says, you're not allowed to bring chametz into the Bahar HaBayis, so that means all the menachot, every korban had soles belula b'shemen, was a menachos, were baked into matzahs, right? And the most sanctified of all of them was actually inside the Beis HaMikdash, on the shulchan. Right inside the Beis HaMikdash itself, there was the menorah, mizbeach, and the shulchan. On the shulchan were what's called lechem hapanim, and the lechem hapanim were all oblong. They were made in square. They weren't round. That was the point that he was making. Nothing holy about the round shape. The only exception, incidentally, to the matzah rule in the Beis HaMikdash was on Shavuot. They had the shtei halechem. The shtei halechem on Shavuot, that was a big chiddush. That they had actual loaves of bread which were made into chametz, and why it was done and how it was done, everything, we'll talk about that close to Shavuos maybe. Yes. It's not complicated. If you think about it for a second, if you've got something pounding the dough, you've got something flattening the dough, which is simply one stainless steel wheel flattening the dough, then you've got a conveyor belt to go straight into the oven. And then it goes, and the conveyor belt goes, doesn't stop. It goes through the oven. You've got a long, long oven, by let's say the length of this room. And while it's going through the oven, it's getting increasingly baked. And then it falls out the other side, and it's done. And it's all regulated. The heat is regulated. The speed is regulated. The pounding is regulated. And you're quite right. It takes only a few minutes. Thank you. Yes. Yes, electric can make the fire. In our day and age, electricity makes the whole machine work. Let's come back for a minute to the question of shmura matzahs, okay? Because that was, if you like, halachically, one of the biggest question mark. Right? It's all very well to say that the machine is much better in terms of ability, hygiene and efficiency in one thing and another, but can it make shmura matzahs? So this was also a big debate between Rav Shlomo Kluger and Rabbi Yosef Shaul Natanzon. That Rabbi Yosef Shaul Natanzon took the view that yes, a machine is simply a tool, right? And just like he says, the person who says the Shei Mitzvahs Matzah and then uses his rolling pin, right? He's using a rolling pin to flatten it out. It's simply a tool. It's a sophisticated tool. But the man who's operating the tool is making L'Shei Mitzvahs Matzah. Apart from which, he says something very interesting. Because there's an interesting question here, the subject really for a whole shiur. The claim was made as follows. If you're going to, let me ask you a question. You've all got a tefillin, mezuzah, sefer Torah, right? Tefillin, mezuzah, sefer Torah, all handmade by a sofer, right? Why do we hand write the mezuzah? Why don't we just print it? You can get a perfectly printed mezuzah, right, for a fraction of the price of the sefer, and let him, and we can save a lot of time and a lot of money. Why do we print it? The answer is that the mezuzah has to be written lishma. It has to be written with the kavana of the sefer has to go into the writing of the words. That's the halacha, right? So the argument was, if you're going to have a machine to make matzahs, maybe you'll have a machine to print mezuzahs as well. That was part of the argument of Rav Shlomo Kluger and the anti-machine matzah camp, right? To which, this gets a little bit technical, beyond the scope of the Shia, but basically the reply to it was that the requirement of matzah is something else completely. The requirement of matzah is actually not that it is made lishma. The requirement of the matzah is that it is shimur lishma, that it is supervised and observed l'shei mitzvahs matzah. It's not the making of the matzah that has to be lishma. It has to be that the people observing it and supervising it have to have in mind that this is l'shei mitzvah. This is not the case, incidentally, with all the objects we use. For example, when you have arba minim on tzluluf, there is no requirement that the arba minim are produced or harvested or whatever l'shei mitzvah. So long as they comply with the halachic regulations, they're kosher, or building a sukkah, or having a shofar. There are lots of objects we use in mitzvahs, which if they comply with the regulations, are kosher. But when it comes to matzahs, there's a special mitzvah of shumaritem es ha-matzahs, to supervise them, to protect them, to look after them, and that, says Rabbi Yosef Shaul Nachman, has to be done lishma. Right, and that can be done even if the machine is ticking over and producing what it produces. So that is the answer to the lishma issue, was that actually the requirement of lishma with matzahs can be perfectly fulfilled with the machine and the person who's pressing the button. Yes. Okay, so that is that. Okay, I'm pleased you told me that. I'm pleased you said that to me. I'm sure that, I don't know if that's true in all factories, but that's a nice, but if you understand the debate, you'll understand why they did that. Right. Normally, you could activate a machine by pressing the button and then going off and having a cup of coffee, right? Right. But what they've done here is, what you've just now said is, and I can understand why they've done this, they've set up the electricity of it in such a way that the man has to keep the button depressed manually all the time, and he has to say l'shei mitzvahs matzah while the machine is running, and that's a very nice addition. Thank you for that. I didn't know that.
When I had that
Santa. Interesting variation. You sit on the button and you say l'shei mitzvahs matzah. Okay, but why is that done? It's done in order to achieve the shemura requirements, the issues of shemur. No, I don't want to overgeneralize here. There were different voices in this whole thing, but generally speaking, the anti-machine people took the view that there's no way to make shmura matzahs with a machine. That was their general view. That saying that the man presses the button and the machine makes it and that's shmura matzahs, that is fake. That was their view. That's what they argued anyway. What I'd like to mention to you, though, is, we're coming towards the end of the Shia, I'd like to just put things a little bit into perspective, bigger picture. When you read these debates, and this is often the case in debates that go nuclear, right? Because why should a debate go nuclear? You can say, look, there are people who use it, our people who don't use it, and that's fine. I mean, why not agree to differ? And you've got both on the shelf, and everyone can decide whether they want to use it or not. What was happening here was actually, big picture, something else completely. The real battle that all these six people were fighting in Europe in the 19th century was the battle against the reform movement, against assimilation, against the Haskalah, right? Which was all part of modernity. And the idea of modernizing Judaism was the biggest enemy of the Torah community. Because the young people of the young people in every community in all these places, whether it was Lvov or whether it was Pressburg or wherever it was, all these rabbonim realized that a large part of the young men and women in their community were being attracted to the universities, to the colleges, to assimilation. Not only assimilation, they were converting out of Judaism. Why were they converting out of Judaism? They wanted to get a job. a job as a lawyer, a job as a doctor, a job as a professor in university. You couldn't get a job if you were Jewish. You had to be a Christian, right? Benjamin Disraeli, the Prime Minister of UK, had to convert in order to be a member of Parliament, He was a member of Parliament in this period. He was a Prime Minister of England during this period, and he was Jewish, but he converted to Christianity because otherwise he couldn't be in Parliament. And that was normal in Europe at the time. You couldn't get any official positions unless you were as a Jew. Right, so the Jewish people, it's true, they were allowed to study, but if you wanted to be accepted into a law practice, you couldn't be a Jew. So you had to abandon Shabbos, you had to abandon Kashrus, and often you had to abandon your Jewish identity. And that was the biggest enemy in Presburg, in Lvov, in Brody, wherever you were, that was the real big issue. And then the question is, how do you combat modernity? How do you do that? Where do you draw the line? So Reb Shlomo Kluger is saying, okay, you know what? We're going to go on a train, and we're going to use modernity to travel. We're going to use modernity, right, to print books. But when it comes to being mekayim mitzvahs, when it comes to doing mitzvahs, are we going to allow these modern, new industrial, technological ideas to change the way we're going to do mitzvahs? No, we're going to do mitzvahs the way we've always done it for generations and generations. We don't want modernity, because modernity is potentially the kiss of death to traditional Judaism in Europe in the 19th century, right? Some people called it the Reform, some people called it the Haskalah, some people, whatever it was, but this was the general, and the sad thing is, in most of these cities, most of the next generation actually abandoned their Judaism because the temptations were unbelievable. The temptations for many of these young, imagine you're a young, talented man or woman in such a community, and you've got a choice. You can either remain frum and remain poor, or you can become knowledgeable and professional and become well-to-do and own your own property and join the goyim. That was the choice. There was no middle path. Right? And therefore, every symbol of modernity was regarded as possible. And what happened was, Nebuch, the square matzah, became a symbol of modernity, right? The square matzah wasn't just a matzah that was baked by a machine. It was matzah that was baked by this industrial revolution, which reflected all that was the biggest problem to Yiddishkeit in the whole world, right? And therefore, behind the debate was this very emotive and very powerful sense of many of the first three people on the sheet here. These first three people took the view that our attitude to dealing with modernity is, we're going to shut down. We're not going to wear their clothes. We're not going to speak their language. We're not going to go to their colleges. We're not going to drink in their coffee shops. We're not going to be involved with them at all, because by doing that, we have a chance of preserving Torah, right? The last three names, right, Rabbi the Ksav Sofer, the Tiferes Yisrael, and Yosef Shaul Natanzon, they were equally frum, and they were equally Haredi as the others were, but they took the view, modernity has a lot to offer us, which is good. Let's use our seichel, and let's be selective. What do we accept from modernity, and what do we reject from modernity? There are certain things which we reject. Of course we reject all that aspect of modernity which draws people away from Yiddishkeit. But if there's this new fantastic way to help us produce matzahs, which are 100% kosher, and which are priced that everybody can buy them, then that's a gift from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's wonderful. That's modernity. So behind the halachic, so there's a halachic debate, there's a debate about hygiene, there's a debate about chometz, there's a debate about all sorts of things, but behind it, there's a much bigger picture. And that's why it's important to understand sometimes the historical context of some of these debates, right? There is something a little bit similar, actually, from that point of view. I'll just finish up by saying this. In our generation, the attitudes towards using techeles in your tzitzis, right? I don't know if you're aware of this fact, but in the last 20, 30 years, there has been a production of a blue dye with which you can color your tzitzis, one part of your tzitzis, blue. Okay? Now this used to be, of course, in the time of the Chumash, and even in the time of the Bais Rishon, there was still tchelet. Everybody had tzitzis, which had a few white strings, and one or two blue strings, and that was the tchelet. And if you read the Kriya Shema, it says, p'til tchelet, you have to put a blue thread on your tzitzis, right? But for the last 2,000 years, that has been lost, because we don't know where to get that blue dye from, right? About less than 100 years ago, research was done in this matter, and they discovered a particular marine snail, right? A marine snail which contains a certain type of liquid, which is a permanent blue dye, and the claim is that this is the accurate source of the tcheles, and now this is being produced commercially. You can go into any shop which sells talis and tzitzis, and you can buy tcheles, right? I've got tcheles on my talis cotton and on my talis gold, I've got tcheles. But there are many rabbonim today, who I've discussed this with, who take the view, our parents didn't wear tcheles, our grandparents didn't wear tcheles, our great-grandparents didn't wear it, I'm going to wear tzitzis like my Zayda wore. I'm not going to allow, and here comes the same line, as I'm not going to allow modern scientists and modern biologists and modern science to tell me how to keep mitzvahs. I'm keeping mitzvahs the way my Zayda kept mitzvahs, and that's it. Don't talk to me about any modern inventions when it comes to how to wear tzitzis. And the mentality is a little bit similar to the machine hand matzahs debate. Because, of course, Yorg Zayda, of course, wore only white threads because he didn't have a choice. There was nothing else available to him. That's why he wore it. He never made a conscious decision not to wear tailors. He just didn't have any choices. There were no decisions available. But you have a choice, right? There is here a possibility to use this tailors. And this tailors is almost certainly exactly authentic. And funnily enough, halachically speaking, there's no downside to it. In other words, even if it's the wrong color, it's not less valid than wearing white. In other words, it can't make it possible that tzitzis. It can only make it more kosher. So there's no real halachic reason not to wear the tchelis, right? But Al Kol Ponim, many rabbonim will not consent to it because of a similar reason as the reasons given for not consenting to machine matzahs. And I think this will change over the next couple of generations. This will change. Bottom line, ladies and gentlemen, it's time to wind up. Go to the shops, and both the machine matzahs and the round matzahs are readily available. They're both kosher lamahadrin. They're both equally excellent. The round matzahs usually cost about 3 times the price of the square matzahs. Lots of people, incidentally, have round matzahs for Seder night just for authenticity, for purposes of aesthetic reasons, or in order that the children should ask. Or we do lots of things on Seder night that the children should, to arouse the interest of the children, having round matzahs they've never seen before the whole year round. They've never seen that. So it is an additional element of something special about Leil Seder. And therefore, I would say, I know that my Rebbe, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, only used machine matzahs. He claimed that machine matzahs were more, you could be more certain about the way in which they were produced, that they didn't even come close to chametz, that there was no room for human error, you weren't at the mercy of the people working. That was his main thing. Whether he used a round matzah for Seder night or not, I've had conflicting reports from people, I don't know exactly. But one thing is certain, that both of them are equally good. Both of them are equally kosher. Make sure you've got a good heksha, which of course you have, and enjoy your Seder night, whether it's round or whether it's square. And if you have anybody at the table who might be interested in the debate, this is an interesting thing to mention on Leil Seder. Look, here we've got round matzahs. Here we've got round matzahs and square matzahs. Did you know that 150 years ago in Europe they were beating each other up over this debate? And here we are, we've resolved it. Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim Chaim. These two things can be combined. Somebody likes to use only one sort, that's fine. But the fight is over, but the ideas behind it are still, I think, very interesting.
Are you giving a shiur next week?
No. Okay, so I'm not giving shiur next week. My wife tells me I'll be busy next week. That is the situation. And we have lots of guests coming from abroad. So I won't be giving shiur next week. Well, the week after, of course, is Pesach. So we're taking a two-week break. And in 3 weeks' time, please God, we will resume. Stay tuned. That's it. Rabbi Yisrael, Chag Sameach. Enjoy a Yom Tov. And think of me when you eat the matzahs. Yeah.